That is all I will say.
Oh, I'm sure you will have more to say before the hour is out. You're quite voluble, even at your most solemn.
Only in defense of the truth,
Lacamue snapped. The truth. Do you remember when we used to debate its nature, rather than blindly defend it? Amatnam asked softly. When we cast our arguments like javelins, and wielded rhetoric like shields. When our name meant something. Lacamue stopped. He looked away, gazing at his blade slaves, as if seeing them for the first time.
Yes, he said finally. Those were more innocent times, before the scales dropped from our eyes and all was revealed to us, when we saw the truth for what it was.
Only it wasn't the truth, was it? Lacamue spun.
Amatnim,
he began warningly. Amatnim looked around.
It wasn't, was it, brothers? There is no one truth, is there? The truth is a multifaceted thing. That is what the Urizen taught us, that the truth is the headwaters of 100 great rivers, and to find it, you must follow one. But we do not all follow the same river, and because of that, we fight. Like the little desert tribes, we wage war over water, while the men of the cities, men like Abaddon, build dams.
He sighed. Once, we were the ones chosen to guide the galaxy to the truth. But now, we are supplanted in our own duty by one who sees the truth only as a means to an end. Heads nodded, and murmurs of quiet assent filtered over the vox. The clamor of preparations had faded, and the rumble of the guns seemed like a storm on the horizon. Amatnam looked at Lacamhew.
You're right, brother. I make sport of us, because we deserve it. We took something glorious, and we carved it up between us, without care for what might come of it. We took handfuls of the truth and enshrined it until it grew stagnant and sour, until it tasted of nothing save poison.
They were all watching him now, even Lacamhew. Amatnam allowed himself a brief flicker of pride.
We drink this poison, brothers, for it is better than dying of thirst. But what we should be doing is breaking the dams.
He paused, letting the moment stretch.
This is why I have led us here, brothers. This system is the first crack in the dam.
He bowed his head. The water, the truth, will flow free, as the gods will.
Apis raised a fist. Gloria Aeterna, he growled.
The others followed his example, and the words beat on the air.
Gloria Aeterna, my brothers! Now, get aboard the gunships. We have a world to burn.
Amatnim raised both of his fists as the other word-bearers snarled in eagerness. They made for their vessels, filled with righteous fire. Amatnim turned to find Lacamhew glaring at him. He laughed at the expression on the dark apostle's face.
You have only yourself to blame, brother.
You baited me.
Yes, I did. But you allowed yourself to be baited.
Amatnim looked up at the gunship.
We should get aboard. It is almost time to launch.
Lacamhew didn't move.
Why? He said softly. Why can you not simply accede to the inevitable? Why must you try to provoke me?
Amatnim turned. The question surprised him. There was something akin to concern in Lacamhew's voice, not the usual wrath or spite. It made him uneasy to hear it.
Why must you incite others to challenge me? He asked after a moment.
Because that is what your faith, as misjudged and mistaken as it is, drives you to do, as my faith drives me. We serve the gods in our own ways, brother. He paused. I hope, one day, you will see that. Otherwise, I will have to kill you. And that will be a sad day indeed. He left Lackenhugh standing there and climbed the boarding ramp. He did not look back to see if the Dark Apostle followed. Chapter 6, 1810-06 Almace, Primaris Grade, Cardinal World. When Calder was shown into the Strategium, Eamon was sitting on the terrace, watching the sunrise.
Beautiful, isn't it? He called out.
Yes. Eamon's guards, crusaders, fell in behind Calder, moving with admirable silence for men in armour. The crusaders watched Calder warily, with hard, flat eyes. He suspected that they were calculating how to cripple or even kill him. He was tempted to ask what conclusion they'd come to. It would be an interesting conversation, if nothing else. Eamon laughed.
Genuine agreement, or more, Palitis, Huskal?
He dismissed his guards with an elegant wave of his hand. They turned and departed without hesitation. I have some sense of aesthetic appreciation, Calder said, as he stepped through the double doors onto the terrace. He saw a cybernetic cherub scuttle away into the curtains of artificially cultivated ivy that draped either side of the terrace, and wondered if this meeting was being recorded.
Sabodan Khan should be meeting with Captain
Keel,
Eamon supplied.
He should be meeting Captain Keel at any moment now.
The fleet will start for Pergamon at the earliest opportunity.
Calder looked up, scanning the sky for any sign of ships leaving the orbital dockyards that cluttered the upper stratosphere.
The Ecumenical Council hasn't met yet, Eamon said with faint protest. Formal permission has not been extended.
There isn't time, unfortunately.
Better to ask forgiveness than permission, Eamon said. He smiled weakly. No matter. They will agree, ex post facto. We will ensure it.
Calder nodded and moved on.
Lieutenant Karros will complete the landing zone preparations. From there, we must begin the work of readying Almace for war.
You think it will come to that? Eamon asked, pulling apart a sweet pastry.
Calder recognized the food as a planetary staple, sugared breads filled with cooked fruits. There were substantial orchards to the southwest. Almost the entirety of the planet's southern hemisphere was given over to agri-production, including a form of native grain.
I think it's a strong possibility.
The fleet will not be able to turn them back?
The fleet will not attempt to do so. Sabodan is not a fool. He will attempt to bleed them and draw them off. But if the preliminary reports from Pergamon are accurate, their numbers are such that it won't make much of a difference. When they arrive, not if, we will be cut off and isolated.
Suddenly I've lost my appetite.
Eamon pushed his half-eaten pastry aside.
What about evacuation?
A waste of resources,
Calder said bluntly.
Evacuations on the scale you're suggesting are often accompanied by panic, riots, civil unrest. There is enough of that going on at the moment.
Calder set one of the data slates he held upon the table.
Speaking of which, I've compiled several potential threat matrices, with breakdowns along cultural, political and economic lines.
Eamon took a swallow of recaf, but made no move to examine the data slate.
How many is several, Lieutenant?
Calder paused.
143.
Eamon winced.
I've heard your sort don't require sleep.
We do. But not as much as a normal human.
Eamon looked up at him.
Are you? A human, I mean. Do you consider yourself such?
Calder frowned.
Of course. What else would I be?
More? Less? Something else?
Calder shook his head.
I am human. That word contains multitudes. I am one of them.
He set down another data slate.
These are the areas of the Cathedral Palace I will require access to immediately. An analysis of potential weak points must be made.
Eamon picked up the data slate. Some of these areas don't exist, he said after a moment. Then, more forcefully, you've made a mistake.
Doubtful. I have studied the composite schematics for this structure. All of these areas exist and are potential weak points in my defensive preparations.
Well, if they exist, I assure you I've never seen them before. I'll ask my staff, however. Some of them have been cluttering up the place for centuries.
As the Cardinal Governor spoke, Calder watched his jaw twitch. A small thing, invisible to the unaugmented eye. He traced the twitch and took note of the variety of micro-expressions occurring across Eamon's face. For a baseline human, the Cardinal Governor had impressive self-control, but Calder recognized the signs of falsehood as clearly as if they were stamped on the man's brow. Eamon was hiding something. For half a second, he considered confronting the man with his observations, but that might have repercussions. There were other ways of learning what he needed to know, ways that didn't endanger his working relationship with Eamon, a relationship that was necessary for the successful defense of Almais.
That would be ideal, he said finally. Thank you.
Eamon flashed a quick smile. I am at your service, Lieutenant. He gestured to the rest of the data slates. Now, what other problems have you brought me? The next 3 hours went quickly. Calder made estimates of everything, ranging from ammunition consumption to ration distribution timetables. Eamon's gaze was growing foggy as the discussion proceeded. Even the Cardinal Governor had his limits, it seemed. When they'd at last finished, Calder said,
You will convene the Ecumenical Council today. We must begin defensive preparation within a day's cycle.
Is that an order or a request? Eamon asked, as a servant cleared away his plate and cup. He gestured, forestalling Calder's reply. Yes, I intend to. I would ask that you be present. Your requests will carry more weight if you deliver them in person.
You wish me to intimidate the council into acquiescence?
Eamon blinked. Are we past the stage for Politis, then? He waved a hand. Never mind. Yes, most of them will not admit that what we face is a system-wide threat. They insist it is the work of raiders, of rebels. They do not want to confront the looming apocalypse.
A curious word.
An old word. It means, literally, an uncovering. A revelation.
Religious?
Eamon nodded. Sometimes. He scratched his chin. It's the slowness of it, I think. We've convinced ourselves that the ending is a thing of sudden fury, rather than a slow suffocation. We see fires on the horizon and think that is where they will stay. But they never do, do they, Lieutenant?
Not in my experience.
And that is why I need you there. I need your experience. You are proof that we stand at a precipice. If you cannot convince them, then they will not be convinced.
And if that is the case?
Eamon looked out over the rail of the terrace. I have a responsibility to this world, to this system, as well as the souls that dwell within it. I have been neglectful, soft perhaps, seeking to balance charity and tyranny. That changes today. Calder felt satisfaction at those words, but also something else, a flicker of what might have been regret. He had read the initial reports of his intercessors, of Kairos's warriors and the White Scars as well. By their standards, the people of Almais were well treated. By the standards of the wider Imperium, this place was a paradise. Even Gilliman might have been impressed. And now, perhaps forever, it was transforming into something else. Plowshares would be beaten into swords, and a place of worship given over to war. As Calder left him there, staring out over his city, he wondered if that was why Eamon had looked so defeated as he said those words, rather than triumphant. Sabodan Khan reclined in his command throne, half watching the hololithic reports that circled him like vultures. He took in the information at a glance,
processing it, and filing it away for later consideration. A sense of anticipation gripped him, making concentration difficult.
"It feels good, doesn't it, Kanim?"
he said to the warrior, standing beside his throne. Like Sabodan himself, Kanim was built for battle. But where his Khan wore all white, Kanim's armor was daubed blue in places, notably on his right arm and shoulder plate. He wore a crystalline force hood over his bare head and held a highly stylized staff in his hands. Kanim was a storm seer, a librarian, a Zadayin Aga, a master of lightning and speaker to spirits of prophecy and storm. His battle plate was covered in lines of delicate Khorchan script. From his belt hung tanned and stretched orc scalps, upon which more lines had been inked by a steady hand. A tulwar was sheathed at his side, its horsehide sheath decorated with the tusks and dried ears of more greenskins. Kanim tapped the pommel of the blade and said,
"Yes, my Khan. Better than wasting our time destroying landing zones."
"Yes, that is a waste of our talents."
He paused.
"Rakan seems to enjoy it, though."
The thought of the chief of the Brotherhood Scouts made him smile. Rakan was old. As an aspirant, Sabodan had learned the art of the silent kill from him, and more besides.
"Rakan is strange," Kanim said.
He leaned against his staff, running his fingers over the equine shapes carved into its length. He murmured to himself, or something else, as he did so, and Sabodan felt an almost electric pulse.
"True. What do these spirits say about our chances, Shaman?"
"That we have the same chance as any man, and better than most."
Sabodan laughed.
"Ha! Good! I'd hate to start out under a cloud of ill omen."
A vox pulse chimed on the throne's comm panel, and he straightened in his seat.
"Ah, at last, they are here."
"Are you certain that this is necessary, my Khan?"
Sabodan smiled lazily.
"We must have no light between our shields, Shaman. Two fleets become one. I intend to impress the importance of unity upon them in person, so that there is no mistaking my commands for requests."
The Imperial Navy was not, as a rule, fond of the subordinate role, especially when it meant submitting to those they saw as intruders upon their domains. The Void was their sea to ply, and they were protective of their independence. Kanim understood this well enough. It was much the same for he and his brothers, but independence had its time and its place, and this was neither. Kanim nodded.
"As you judge best, my Khan."
"I hear a hint of disapproval in your voice, Shaman."
"Only a hint, my Khan."
"See that it stays that way,"
Sabodan grunted. He drew his tulwar and set it across his knees in preparation for what was to come. He doubted he would have to use it. There were few things more intimidating to officers of the Imperial Navy than the ships of the Adeptus Astartes. The White Scar's battle barge was far more advanced than any vessel in the System Defense Fleet. It was built to wage wars alone in the deepest shadows of known space. By itself, the Silent Horseman could shatter the Navy's remaining vessels. When paired with the rest of the ships under Sabodan's command, it would be a force to be feared. They would harry the foe, bleeding them of men and material only as a White Scar could. They would ride across the stars and laugh as they killed. Sabodan forced a smile from his face as the captains of the System Defense Fleet were shown onto the bridge by a chapter serf. He studied them with hooded eyes, noting their nervousness. That was good. Nervous men were more apt to pay attention.
"Welcome," he said.
At the sound of his voice, they tensed. They were a motley handful, most well past retirement age, or too young for their command. Their records and commendations were listed on the projections that hovered about his throne. Jonas Keel, captain of Orlando's Wrath, had the most seniority. Captain Ogilvy of the Crassus was a retired Commodore captain, with almost a century of active military experience in her favour. In contrast, Captain Belmont of the Drusus was young, inexperienced, but with over a dozen commendations to his name. The captains of the frigates were much the same. a mix of old and young, veterans and aspirants. He was reminded of Armageddon and his time with the fleets there. They had been bled white by the decades of war, and there had been too many beardless faces at the strategic briefings for his liking. Then, perhaps it was simply the way of things. The old gave way to the new. In time, warriors like him might be supplanted by those like Calder, better able to weather a rapidly changing universe. He pushed the thought to the back of his mind, wondering which of those before him would seize the moment to speak first. That would be the one he would need to convince. The others would follow like good cattle.
"Well?" he asked. "Speak up!"
"Careful, you'll frighten them,"
Canem murmured in Korchin, voice pitched low. Sabodin gestured irritably. Keel coughed, straightened his coat and stepped forward. He stood ramrod straight, one fist pressed to his chest. "Keel, my lord,
I...
Sabodin waited for him to elaborate, but the man appeared to have forgotten what he was going to say. It didn't matter. The White Scar sighed and leaned forward.
"Greetings, Captain Keel. I welcome you, and these others aboard my vessel. I thank you for agreeing to meet with me at such short notice."
It galled him somewhat to be polite. They knew why he was here and what he wanted, but he had to at least pretend to ask. Otherwise, they might prove obstreperous, and then he would have to kill some of them. Keel looked nervous. They all looked nervous. Sabodin did not blame them. He knew he was an intimidating presence, even when he was smiling. Perhaps especially when he was smiling. Canon gave the captain a supportive nod, but Keel paid him little notice. His eyes were on Sabodin, and the heavy tulwar laying across his knees. That was good.
"You are in command of the System Defense Fleet now," Sabodin rumbled.
Keel nodded jerkily.
I have that honor."
"It is good you think of it that way. I am told a brave man died to make it so."
Sabodin stroked the horse-eyed sheath that hid the Tulwar's killing edge. He looked past Keel at the other captains. The fleet was pitifully small by the standards of the Imperium. But it would do. Even the smallest blade could kill, in the right hands.
"In any event, it doesn't matter. As of this moment, I am taking command of the fleet. All vessels will obey my orders. Any captains who wish to submit their resignations may do so."
The captains looked at one another, startled save for Keel, who looked relieved. Sabodin pushed the thought aside.
"If you wish to surrender your responsibilities, be quick, though. I will brook no delay in setting course for Pergamon."
You cannot take command without orders from the Cardinal Governor," Keel said, looking as if he'd rather be anywhere else.
Sabodin stared at him, wondering if this was defiance or simply an excess of duty.
"We have that."
"And the Ecumenical Council," Keel began hesitantly.
"We'll agree in their own time. But there is no time to wait for them to convene and voice that agreement. Thus, I meet with you."
Sabodin let his gaze rest on each of the captains in turn, judging them, weighing what he saw against the stories their records told.
"Do any here wish to contest my orders?"
Keel turned, studied the others, and then looked back at Sabodin.
"No, my lord," he said. "They'll follow you to the Iron Back, if you ask it."
He stood straight and stiff, jaw set. In that moment, Sabodin knew him for a good officer, whatever his earlier hesitancy. The burden of overall command lifted, Keel had instinctively fallen into the role of able second. Sabodin knew he could count on the man to ride herd on the others and keep them in line. That boded well.
"That is good. But luckily, I do not think we have to travel that far to find the enemy."
Sabodin rose from his throne.
"Back to your vessels. Make her ready. We shall depart at the earliest opportunity."
He turned to Canem.
"Go with them," he murmured in Korchin. "Take their measure. I want to be certain that they'll do as I say without hesitation."
Canem nodded.
"As your command, my Khan." He thumped the deck with his staff. "Come, my friends. Allow me to escort you to the launch bay."
As they departed, Sir Bodin turned.
"Well, brother, what are your thoughts?"
The commander of the Raven Guard cruiser, Raven's Valor, stood just behind his command throne, frowning. The other Space Marine had observed his meeting with the captains in watchful silence, as was the way of his chapter. Sometimes they were so quiet it set Sir Bodin's teeth on edge. He doubted Kiel and the others had even noticed that the Raven Guard was there.
"If we are to fight together, we must know each other's minds, Ruquin."
Ruquin was short for a Raven Guard. They tended to the tall end of the spectrum. But he had his chapter's pallid complexion and dark eyes. His head was shorn smooth, save for a flat mohawk of grey hair. Old shrapnel scars pulled parts of his face in different directions. It made trying to read his expression difficult.
"They are barely holding on," Ruquin said flatly. "Their morale is shaken. Their current commander is hesitant. And they have taken too many losses of late. They need a victory, or they'll splinter at the first engagement."
Sir Bodin nodded.
"My thoughts exactly. Suggestions?"
Ruquin paused. Sir Bodin gestured.
"Speak up, brother! Now is the time to make your opinion known. Once we are on the hunt, I'll have little patience for it."
"Little victories," Ruquin said. "We pick the bones, follow the enemy, hit them when they're distracted."
"Good. Those are my thoughts as well."
Sir Bodin leaned back, satisfied. It was good when commanders agreed on a course of action. Things would flow more smoothly. The less he had to take into consideration, the better.
"You'll take secondary command of the cruisers, Crassus and Drusus, as well as a third of the escorts. Orlandos Roth will ride with the Silent Horsemen and the remaining escorts. We'll divide the fleet into two for the first engagement, draw them in, and we'll spear them in the flank.
And afterwards?"
"We break contact, bleed them and draw off. We'll split into smaller forces and scatter, only regrouping when necessary."
Ruquin nodded slowly.
"Take them piecemeal, rather than head on."
He rubbed his battered features.
"Where do we start?"
Sir Bodin gestured to one of the hololithic projections that surrounded his command throne.
"Where else? Pergamon. By the time we arrive, they'll have taken over that world, or broken themselves on it. Either way, they won't be in any shape to resist."
He gave a tiger's grin.
"And then we will paint the stars with their blood."
Canem only noticed Kiel was missing when they reached the launch bay. Leaving the others in the hands of their escorts, he retraced his steps. It would be an inauspicious omen to lose one of their captains before they'd even set out. He found the mortal standing at an observation port. Great windows of void-hardened glass rose in high cathedral frames. Through them, the Stormseer could see frigates drifting like drowsy leviathans through the sea of stars.
"Beautiful," Kiel said softly.
"Is it?"
Kiel jolted.
My apologies, Lord. I did not..."
He gestured to the windows.
"I was distracted by the view. I'm afraid. A failing of mine I have yet to correct."
Canem waved him to silence.
"No offence taken or meant, Commodore Captain. I am sorry if I startled you."
He stood in silence beside Kiel for a moment. Then,
"You comported yourself well. Sir Bodin Khan is not often impressed." "He did not seem impressed to me." "You still have your head."
Kiel laughed sourly. After a moment, he said,
"We're going back out there, aren't we? You're stripping the system bare and taking us into battle."
Canem nodded.
"We are. What about Almes? We are leaving the Imperial Fist strike cruiser Capulus and a complement of escorts. They know about defending worlds. Almes is in good hands."
Kiel nodded.
"Truth is, I'm relieved. I'm not... I wasn't cut out for fleet command. A ship I can handle. You know where you're at with a ship. Everyone does their job and everyone lives to see another day. But a fleet... too much talking. Too much politicking. It feels like you have to oversee their ships as well as your own."
He sighed.
"I don't know how Aldo did it, honestly."
"Aldo?
Commodore Captain Ware. Keel scrubbed a hand over his unshaven chin. A good man. Good commander. I wish... He trailed off. My apologies again, my lord. I shouldn't have wandered off. Sometimes the spirits take us off the path so that we might learn something new. Kenan gazed at Keel and saw the ghosts of regret and yearning coil about him. The strands of the man's fate were stretched almost taut. His destiny was close to being decided, whether he was aware of it or not. Part of the Stormseer was tempted to follow those strands back to their beginning, to read the story of the man before him. But there was no time for such idle diversions. Not now. Not here. Keel looked up at him.
I think I'm too old to learn anything new.
He looked around.
This is a fine vessel, though. I used to think Orlando's Wrath was the most beautiful ship this side of Mars. But this one outshines her.
He paused.
A funny name, though.
Canem chuckled. He was starting to see why a captain with as much seniority as Keel had never been promoted to command his own fleet before now. Keel made to apologize again, but Canem waved it aside.
Originally, this vessel was dubbed the Plainsmaster, he said. You changed the name?
Keel sounded aghast. Canem smiled. The Imperial Navy had many superstitions. Names featured heavily in many of them.
Sometimes things change. In this case, it was in honor of the battles it waged in the Sea of Stars above Armageddon.
He looked at Keel.
Under Sabodan's command, it fought alongside the ships of the Imperial Navy. We bloodied the Hain.
He paused, noticing the look of confusion on Keel's face.
Orcs, he clarified. I don't speak Korchan. I did not expect you to do so.
Canem smiled.
We killed orcs with your kind. Now we will kill other enemies, but only if you do as we say.
Keel nodded.
We'll follow where you lead.
Canem paused.
No hesitation. Is it so heavy a burden, then?
It was Keel's turn to smile. There was precious little mirth in it.
As I said, I'm not cut out for command. A ship is about the limit of my competence. A man who knows his limits builds walls for himself.
Keel laughed.
Walls serve to keep the enemy at bay.
Canem nodded. He was coming to like Keel. The man was no fool, and had few illusions as to his place in the scheme of things. Some might have called it a lack of confidence, but Canem knew it to be anything but. Keel was a stone set into a river. Whichever way the river went, the stone would not move. For better or worse, it held its place, as Keel would. He saw it now, more clearly than before. And he saw other things besides. The spirits whispered a word in his ear, and Canem felt the prick of icy claws upon his soul. His smile did not falter, though suddenly he knew that Keel was not the only one coming to the end of his thread. For a moment, the air about him seemed red with the blood of the fallen. The moment passed away as quickly as it had come, but as they walked to the landing bay, Canem could not help but tighten his grip on his staff, seeking comfort in its solidity. There was death on the air. Only time would tell whose.
Chapter 7 300016 Odoasa System, Spinward Edge. Prince Ganor Kabalevsky awoke suddenly, heart thudding. Panicked, he wondered where he was, but only for a moment. He felt the familiar throb of the engines through the hull, like a giant's pulse. He was aboard his ship, his vessel, a Havoc-class frigate called Kabalevsky's Wrath, hung at the outer edge of the Axim Cluster, near the system's Spinward Edge. They had been docked at the Wolf's Head facilities there for a standard week, since their last run-in with the System Defense Fleet. Ganor had won the frigate in a card game, and had made it one of the most feared vessels in the Outer Sector. Twice he'd fought his way out of traps set by the System Defense Fleet, trusting in the vessel's firepower and speed to carry his crew to safety. This third time, however, they had come closer than he liked. He looked around. His private quarters stank of spilled alcohol and sweat. He fumbled for the Hegen pipe, longing to suck the sweet-smelling smoke into his lungs. It was the only thing that could calm him when he felt the way he did now. The pipe was empty. More was the pity. Annoyed, he swept it aside and clambered out of bed, ignoring the protests of his bedmates. He didn't immediately recognize them. They weren't members of his crew. They were from the facility then. Wolf's heads were a fact of life in a system like Odoacer. Outlaw refueling stations, run by renegade Mechanicus Magi, or wildcat entrepreneurs. They purchase asteroids off the books, avoiding the notice of administratum bureaucracy. They were willing to refit and repair private vessels for a price, sometimes money, but occasionally more esoteric prizes. Ganor and the other pirates who haunted the system's fringes were only too willing to pay those prices to stay one step ahead of the system defense fleet. Shrugging into his robe, he snapped his fingers.
"Get out!"
They protested in slurred voices. He sighed and reached for the shuriken pistol, hanging in its holster from the bedpost. They scrambled out of bed and out of his quarters as he drew it. The Xenos weapon felt pleasingly warm in his grip. Like his ship, he'd won it in a card game. He laughed softly and looked around his quarters. They were a mess. Empty bottles and dirty clothes littered the floor. He dimly recalled having recently shot his servant.
"That didn't explain it, then," he murmured.
He ran his palms over his shorn scalp and studied himself in the mirror that hung along the far wall. He was tall and spare, with an aristocratic bearing. Tattoos marked his face, neck, and bare chest. He'd had them done by a renegade Aldari of his acquaintance, the same Aldari he'd won the pistol off, and a coat as well. The tattoos were special. Good luck, or so the Xenos had sworn. They bound Ganor's soul to his flesh, or some such rot. He traced the swooping angles and curves idly, admiring himself. He was the very picture of Almacian aristocracy. He frowned, only he wasn't, not any longer. The Kabalevsky name had been one to conjure with, as the saying went, but now it was as dust. The familial holdings were gone, their titles bartered away to lesser clans, and all thanks to one man.
"Aemon,"
he said, making the name sound like a curse. The Cardinal Governor himself had signed the orders, exiling Ganor and his family, banishing them from Almace. His father had died soon after, drowning himself in a bottle. His mother had faded to a shadow of her former self, until one day there had been nothing left of her at all, just a body, sitting in a corner, murmuring to people who weren't there. And all for what? Treason, they'd said. Was it treason to attempt to undo a gross error? The Ecclesiarchy had no right to the throne of Almace, whatever the law bequested.
"It was ours," he murmured, staring at his reflection. "It was yours."
Ganor paused, as he always did when he heard the voice. It had been with him for as long as he could remember, though it had grown loud of late. His reflection seemed to smile at him.
"The throne is yours by right. Almace is yours."
"Yes."
Idly, he traced his tattoos. He remembered the way the Aldari had grinned at him, and the look of surprise on its inhuman features as he'd shot it.
"Filthy creature, trying to trick a prince."
"Yes, filthy," he said absently.
He made a good living, preying on the trade routes that stretched the length of the system. More than enough to keep his crew happy, and himself in the luxury he deserved. The system merchants of Odoacer were fat and weak. Easy prey, if you had the nerve. Occasionally, when he could talk some sense into his fellow captains, they even managed to take a rogue trader or two. There was enough plunder there to see them through a standard year, if they were careful.
It isn't enough.
No, he said softly.
You deserve more.
It is mine by right,
he said out loud. He rubbed his temples, trying to recall what had woken him so suddenly. It had been a dream. Or had it? He'd seen... What had he seen? The images were hazy, hard to decipher. There had been a light.
The light of truth.
And a battle standard, burning.
The standards of your foes.
And something, someone else. A man. No, not a man. More than a man. A space marine. Ganor shivered. He'd seen them, in his youth, but only at a distance. They towered over his parents and the other nobles, like demigods of war. He closed his eyes. His head ached with the weight of sleep.
No more time for sleep, young prince. They are coming. The bearers of the word will show you the way.
The vox unit in his quarters chimed. Slowly, he turned to it. He stared at it, dully.
Answer it.
He glanced at his reflection. And for a moment, he didn't recognize himself. He felt a thrill of fear run through him, but it quickly faded. What was there to be afraid of here, or in all the galaxy? Was he not Prince Ganor Kabalevsky? Was he not the true heir to the throne of Almace? The vox unit chimed again. Urgently, he answered it, and his reflection smiled. Pergamon, Secundus Grey Tithe World. Amatnim strode across the marble floor, the echoes of his steps preceding him. Mighty pillars carved resembling coiling stairways, and now crowded with pilgrims, rose to either side of him. Beyond them, immense bookcases filled the walls from floor to ceiling. Millions of books filled the repository. Ancient texts, diligently compiled across the centuries by the adherents of a dead god. Now, many lay scattered across the floors, and loose papers sifted through the air like falling snow. The floor shook as an explosion gripped the street. Pacifying the city was taking longer than he'd anticipated. Its defenders were tenacious, driven to extremes by their false faith. Every street, every crossing, would be consecrated in blood before the end. Somewhere, demons were howling in pleasure as they loped through the dying metropolis, hunting souls. He felt their savage calls resonate through him, and felt a brief flicker of pity for their quarry. But he quickly quashed it. Such was the well-deserved fate of all who failed to acknowledge the gods. Ignorance was no excuse for such sacrilege. And yet, was it not the task of he and his brothers to purge such ignorance from the species? Was it not their duty to bring the truth to those blinded by lies? What was truth to a dead man save a eulogy? He sighed, unable to answer his own questions and annoyed by the distraction. He had other matters to think about. Pergamon had not yet fallen. The city had not yet fallen. But it would. He passed through an archway shaped like a rising angel and into the northern chamber of the library. The massive chamber was circular and rose to a domed roof, decorated with an enormous mural depicting some noteworthy event in the planet's history. It had three floors, the upper two shaped like rings, so that those above might look down on the ground floor. Large shelves lined the curving walls on each floor, and a forest of stone pillars rose from the level, passing through the upper reaches to support the roof. Spiral staircases encircled many of these pillars, connecting the different levels. This was but one part of the library. A dozen more chambers of similar size and shape encircled the central tower, which seemingly doubled as a bastion. Each was connected to the central tower by a short causeway, dominated by security archways.
So far, his followers had had little luck breaching those archways, thanks mostly to the efforts of the library's defenders. Throughout the chamber, mortals, clad in the stained remnants of old uniforms and plundered armour, flung books into a great pile, laughing as they laboured. As the eminent Corferin had written in his 75th treatise on faith, joy was found only in servitude. Imatnim watched the mortals and nodded in satisfaction.
Good,
he murmured.
My lord?
Imatnim turned.
Yes, Apis. Something for your collection, my lord.
Apis extended the volume.
Poetry, I believe. Though I am no judge of literary merit.
Imatnim laughed.
A trait we share, brother.
He opened the book gently, mindful of the ash and blood that stained his gauntlets. Outside, an explosion rocked the street. Bolt guns growled, and the screams of the dying drifted on the wind, like the sweetest music.
How goes it, then? The city is on fire. Our doing? No.
Imatnim looked up from the book.
They set their own city on fire.
Apis reached up and removed his helm. His face was streaked with sweat, blood and ashes.
Someone did.
Well, that is the calibre of our opponents, destructive in defeat as well as victory.
What about the central bastion?
Apis hesitated.
The defenders are proving obstinate.
Imatnim laughed.
That's one word for it.
The convent of battle sisters occupying the bastion were putting up a fierce resistance. He'd expected no less.
Have we found the Lord Deacon yet? Fortified bunker farther up the crater slope,
Apis grunted, watching as an entire shelf of sermons went into the fires.
Set deep into the bedrock. We haven't cracked it yet either. Duceppe is in charge. You know how he enjoys such puzzles. If he weren't so good at spouting catechisms, I'd swear he was one of Perturabo's curs.
Imatnim nodded.
Yes.
What is it, he always says? Something about sieges.
Sieges are the whetstone of a soldier's faith,
Apis recited.
Ah, that's it. Very well, leave him to it. If nothing else, it keeps the defenders preoccupied.
That was Imatnim's way of war. Divide the enemy, prevent them from making any sort of concentrated defence. The key was to have subordinates who could be trusted to pursue their own initiative. It made little difference whether they did so out of loyalty or ambition, so long as they succeeded. The city would be theirs by nightfall, or the morning after, if things continued apace. Once they found the Lord Deacon, he would be convinced to send out a message calling for the peaceful surrender of the remaining defence forces. Most of them would ignore him, but some would seize the opportunity to join the winning side. They always did. Humans were pragmatic creatures at heart, and for the unenlightened, one god was the same as another. They would learn the difference soon enough.
Nay. Do not see the Dark Apostle anywhere,
Apis said.
I wonder if the gods have gifted us with his death.
Careful, brother. I can get away with such blasphemy, but you cannot.
Apis frowned.
Here's all bluster, that one. Not a real warrior.
No, but his blade slaves are, and he will set them on you with no hesitation.
Why do you put up with him?
The question was just shy of impertinent. But Imatnim treasured these brief moments of informality. Apis was a good soldier, loyal and faithful. 100 such, and he could have conquered any world, any system.
He serves Erebus, and Erebus is part of the Dark Council,
as is Corferin.
Exactly.
Imatnim held up the book, balanced on his palm.
Equilibrium. That is our way. We worship all gods equally, and so enjoy the boons and blessings of the pantheon. One master might lead us astray. Many masters keep us to the path. But despite all their pulling and pushing, or even because of it, we can but go forward.
The Urizen was wise, and foresaw that without such balance, we might become as Fulgrim's Catamites or Angron's Lunatics. In every host, there is balance. Many leaders sometimes working at odds to ensure that the will of the gods is manifested. Apis grunted and shook his head.
Sure. Sometimes I think I prefer the old ways, with Lorgar at our head and our guns aimed at the enemy, rather than each other.
Amatlin nodded, though he knew it had never truly been like that. The Urizen had pitted his sons against each other even before they found the truth. He had tested their faith through competition and fostered rivalries. The strongest, the most faithful, had risen, and those weak of faith or lacking in skill had fallen, just like now. This, too, was a time of testing. The galaxy was in upheaval. A great revelation was in process, and the bearers of the word would need to be ready. The Urizen waited, letting his sons sharpen their sacrificial knives on each other to weed out those unfit to serve him in the apocalypse to come. Amatnim knew that he would be found worthy. The gods had whispered this to him, even as they'd set his feet on the path to glory. He would fight at Lorgar's side again. But first, the truth would be revealed. The Legion would at last pass the test the Urizen had set. Amatnim would be the one to show them the way. A cry made him turn. A word-bearer thudded towards them, forcing a pair of sisters' dialogus before him.
I found these rats scurrying for safety, my lord.
The word-bearer rumbled, his helm's vox grill turning his voice into a growl.
You wished us to take prisoners. I thought it best to bring them to you.
Amatlin nodded.
Yes, and they're in one piece. Very good. Gormlech, is it?
He paused.
You came with the Dark Apostle, I believe.
Gormlech struck his chest with a fist and bowed.
I have that honour, my lord.
Apis snorted, and Gormlech glanced at him. His helm, wrought in the shape of a demon's snarl, seemed to twist into a grimace, but he said nothing. Amatnim motioned for Apis to be silent, and turned his attention to the women. They were both old, by the standards of mortals. Their hair was grey and cropped short, and their wrinkled faces were like cracked sandstone. Both were bruised and bloody, their hands bound before them by strips, torn from their own robes. But they stared at him in wary defiance.
"Do you know this book?"
he asked them, holding up the volume Apis had brought him.
"Do you recognize it?"
He waited. When no answer was forthcoming, he gave a terse nod. Gormlech growled, grabbed one of the women by the neck, and drove two fingers into the small of her back. She spasmed as her vertebrae cracked and cried out in pain.
A bit harder, and Gormlech would have crippled you,
the Madnim said.
A bit higher, and you would have died. Do you know this book?
The woman spat at him. Amatnim nodded, and Gormlech drove a finger into the base of her skull. She staggered as he released her, and her companion was forced to catch her before she fell.
A bit higher, a bit harder, and he would have punctured your skull. You have one more chance. Do you know this book?
Yes, the other woman said, her voice hoarse. Yes, damn you! We know every book in this library. Every book, every shelf, every page.
Good. That means you know this place well. Tell me, where is the vault?
The woman stared. What vault? He sighed, reading the lie in her eyes and the calculation. He considered torturing it out of her, but knew it would be futile. He realized that he'd made a mistake mentioning the vault. They'd die before they told him, now that they knew why he was here.
As I expected. Burn it! All of it!
Amatnim tossed the book aside.
Turn their lies to ash, my brothers! Teach them the penalty for such heresies.
The women howled in despair, not for themselves, he knew, but for the books. In a way, he admired such devotion. Would that more servants of the Dark Gods had such dedication to their words. Gormlaith reached for one, chortling, but he paused, hand outstretched.
My lord, do you hear?
Amatnam did. He recognized the hiss of superheated air an instant before Gormlaith's head was reduced to bubbling slag.
Take cover!
He bellowed.
Ambush!
Even as the words left his mouth, bolt guns sang, their harsh rumble crack splitting the air. Mortal slaves fell, bodies torn apart by the high-velocity rounds. Blood slopped across the marble. Amatnam took a step back, as small impact craters formed on his armor. An automatic targeting array spun across his visor, tracing the trajectories back to their point of origin. His hand fell to the bolt pistol holstered at his side, even as the targeting runes locked onto heat signatures and flashed crimson. He drew and fired smoothly, already in motion. Around him, Apis and the few other word-bearers present sought cover behind pillars and toppled shelves. Amatnam slid into the lee of a pillar beside Apis.
Six targets, second level, dead ahead, he said, without preamble.
Four more, third level, to our left,
Apis growled. His bolt gun roared as he sprayed the bookcases on the second floor of the library.
They've caught us in a crossfire! You have my word that the sentries will be punished for this, my lord. Given the situation, I suspect they have already gone to meet the gods. But I thank you for the assurance regardless, brother.
Amatnam activated the command vox channel.
Report! Casualties! Besides Gormlaith, I mean.
The others sounded off from their positions throughout the chamber. No further Legion casualties as yet, though their mortal servants were dying in droves. Then, that was what they were there for. Every bullet they took was one less to strike a brother. Indeed, a mortal's greatest joy was to die for their master. Their blood consecrated the ground and their screams were as music to the gods, who would consume their small souls and make them as one with the primordial truth. Apis winced as a ricochet dug a bloody groove across his cheek. He hastily donned his helm.
We were overconfident,
he said, as it locked into place.
We assumed that the causeways were the only way in or out.
Amatnam nodded. The air was full of ash and burning paper, and his auto-senses fuzzed and whined as they attempted to compensate.
Given the rate of fire from the third level, I'd say they brought a heavy bolter.
And a melter gun, given the state of Gormlaith's head,
Apis said. He leaned around the pillar and snapped off a shot.
They must have followed the inobservant fool right back to us.
Well, he's paid for his mistake.
Amatnam heard the telltale hiss of superheated air again.
Down!
He and Apis crouched as the unseen melter gun vomited a wash of heat. An unlucky cultist was caught full in the chest and came apart in a cascade of burnt flesh and scalded bone.
They'll try grenades next to flush us out!
He tracked the path of the melter gun, estimating the position of its wielder. The clouds of smoke and paper hampered his targeting array, but he fired regardless. His faith was rewarded by a sharp cry and a glimpse of a grey-armoured form stumbling briefly out of cover. Though the battle plate they wore was inferior to that of the word-bearers, it still gave them some protection.
Apis! I see her!
Apis's bolt gun cracked, and the battle sister spun away, half her head gone.
Moving!
Amatnam said, hurrying towards the dead woman's position, firing as he went. Apis and another word-bearer followed, covering him. As Amatnam reached another pillar, he heard a shout and the roar of a heavy bolter.
Cover!
He growled, gesturing for Apis and his companion to seek safety. The two space marines dropped flat and began to crawl. Amatnam stepped out from behind the pillar and fired, his shots smashing through shelves and sending an avalanche of books spilling onto the floor. With the enemy momentarily distracted, Apis and the other word-bearer managed to reach him. Amatnam recognized him as Yattle, another of Lackamhew's lackeys. He nodded amiably to the warrior, wondering if Yattle would seek to take advantage of the situation. A shot in the back, and the battle sisters as the obvious culprits.
Where did they come from?
Yattle growled, loosing a burst at the second level.
There must be some way in or out of the central bastion that we missed,
Imatnim said.
We need to conduct an all-spec sweep, grid by grid.
He reloaded briskly, ignoring the chunks being chewed from the pillar.
I want it found, before they have a chance to seal it again.
Apis signalled acknowledgement and bent forward. Imatnim heard the click of the vox as he swung out from behind the pillar and snapped off a shot blind. His targeting array spun, momentarily clear. It highlighted less than 20 potential targets.
Less than I thought, he murmured.
Maybe they're attempting to escape,
Yattle said. He bent around the pillar and fired.
Come out, you cowards!
He bellowed a moment later.
The dark gods thirst for your souls!
Yes, I'm sure that will convince them,
Apis muttered.
Would you have me ask them nicely?
I would have you stop yammering and show some fire discipline,
Apis growled.
Enough, Imatnim said. They aren't trying to escape. This is a reconnaissance in force.
He activated his vox link so that the others could hear him.
Now that they've lost the advantage of surprise, they'll be retreating. We cannot let them get away. Ready yourselves!
A chorus of clicks assured him that the others had heard and would obey. Though they had spent millennia in the Eye of Terror, his warriors were all veterans and still held to the discipline that had carried them through the Great Crusade and the Heresy. Those who did not soon found that faith alone rarely carried the day. He needed fire and steel to back it up.
On my mark, he growled.
Opposing fire began to slacken. He recognized the tactical pattern. He'd used it himself often enough. The women would be falling back in stages, through the forest of shelves and pillars. Some would move, the rest would provide covering fire. They would take up new positions every few moments, fire and retreat. Aided by the inbuilt systems of his battleplate, he analyzed the rate and direction of enemy fire until he'd pinpointed a gap in the pattern.
Now,
he said. He swung out from behind the pillar and fired again and again as he advanced through the storm of falling paper and ash. Apis and Yattle followed his example, flanking him, their bolt guns lighting up the shadows between shelves. Imatnim could see them now. Grey shapes in carnelian tabards, retreating through a ruin of toppled shelves and blasted pillars. He could hear the hunting howls of the surviving cultists as they loped through the chamber, following their masters. He fired again, and a woman screamed. She fell, and one of her sisters caught her by her robes, dragging her backwards. The wounded woman continued to fire her bolt gun, despite the trail of red smeared on the floor in her wake.
Brave!
Apis said.
Wretched animals,
Yattle said. Imatnim said nothing. Yattle was wrong, but he would learn in time, if someone didn't kill him first. He paused, and the other word-bearer stalked past, chanting loudly. Apis stopped as well, head cocked.
Something?
He asked.
Why this way?
Imatnim said. He turned, scanning the heights. He could hear bolter fire above, and the vox crackled with voices, and something else. A fluctuation of static, interference on the vox link.
Listen.
Apis turned.
Is that a vox signal?
Yes, but a signal for what?
Imatnim whirled.
Yattle! Pull back!
What?
Yattle paused. The interference rose to a shrill whine, and Imatnim caught Apis by the shoulder plate and jerked him back as something monstrous stepped into view. The hulking machine shouldered aside a shelf, sending it crashing to the floor. A voxcaster strapped to its chassis blared a hymn to the God Emperor, and the hateful sound filled the chamber, drowning out all but the loudest explosions.
Dark gods! What is that?
Apis muttered across the vox.
They call it a penitent engine,
Imatnim said. The penitent engine was a skeletal frame set atop two jointed legs with two long arms. Within the frame, a pilot writhed in a nest of wires, tubes and chemical injectors. The woman was emaciated, her scarred and bloody form shrouded in a filthy tabard, and chains strung with funerary bells.
Her face was hidden beneath a cowl, marked with the sigil of the ecclesiarchy. Wasted limbs twitched, and an arm swung out from a groin of pneumatic pistons. At the other end was the seared nozzle of a heavy flamer, surmounted by the jagged blade of a chain fist. Yattle was hurled backwards by the blow, the chain fist drawing sparks from his battle plate. He cursed and crawled back towards Amatnim and Apis, his armor bleeding lubricant in smoke. The penitent engine stomped after him, its controller twitching in her harness.
"Get him up!"
Amatnim said as he tried to draw a bead on the pilot. She was exposed, intentionally so, but the war engine's movements made it difficult. It thrashed so erratically, his targeting display had a hard time catching up. Its chain blades tore through shelves and pillars as it clomped towards them. The voxcaster blared prayers and curses as the pilot twitched in something that might have been religious ecstasy.
"Ambush!"
Apis said as he dragged a cursing Yattle back the way they'd come. From above came the sound of bolt guns. The other word-bearers had realized what had happened, and they paused in their advance to shoot at the rampaging machine. The penitent engine replied in kind, its heavy flamers washing across the upper levels and setting shelves and word-bearers ablaze.
"Distraction!"
Amatnim said, as the vox crackled with pain screams.
"Grenade! I should..."
Apis began, but Amatnim shook his head. Chain blades hacked through the pillars and cut down any cultists who got too close. He was forced to duck aside as a twitching body hurtled past, trailing ragged lengths of intestine.
"Grenade! Now!"
Apis unhooked a grenade from his armor and tossed it to Amatnim. Amatnim paused, waiting until the engine was preoccupied with the warriors above, before sprinting towards it. He primed the grenade as he ran, knowing he would only get one chance. The penitent engine spied him as he drew close and whirled, chain blade screaming as it slashed towards him. He fell to his knees and bent backwards, sliding across the blood-slick floor. The chain blade bit the air just over his head, and he twisted, hurling the grenade into the nest of cables, pistons and wires that hung from its back. The machine turned, following him as he rolled to his feet, bolt pistols spitting. His shots pierced the number of cables and fat sparks of electricity danced on the air. The pilot shrieked out nonsense litanies, her tattered lips peeled back from rotten teeth. The subsequent explosion cut those short. The penitent engine staggered, bleeding oil. The chain blade struck the floor, digging into the ancient marble. Fire gouted from the heavy flamers and washed across the floor, driving Amatnim back. The pilot's ragged tabard was set alight, as were the spilled puddles of oil. She shrieked and thrashed in her harness, forcing the war engine to its feet. Its movements were noticeably slower this time, more awkward. The brutal grace it had displayed earlier was gone. The pilot's cowl was wreathed in flames as the penitent engine staggered towards Amatnim. He backed away, firing. Past the machine, he saw Apis and several other word-bearers approaching. They opened up on the war machine, and the pilot screamed, as if the engine were a part of her. Instinctively, she turned, filling the air with fire. Amatnim darted forward through the flames. He caught a handful of cabling and hurled himself up. He shoved the barrel of his bolt pistol against the pilot's burning cowl and pulled the trigger. The penitent engine made a sound deep in itself, like the groan of a dying beast. Then, with a hiss of pneumatics, it sank down, the pilot's carcass hanging limp in the frame. Amatnim dropped to the floor as it fell.
"Keep moving!"
he waved Apis and the others ahead.
"We've wasted enough time as it is!"
He moved to where Yattle lay.
"Can you move, brother?"
"With help?"
Yattle made to hurl himself up, awkwardly.
"My power armor's unit was breached. Joints are seizing up."
He looked up at Amatnim.
"Repairable, with time."
Amatnim helped, supporting him.
"I'm curious, brother. Do you recall Erebus's sermon on the slopes of Sabine?"
Yattle looked at him.
"Yes,"
he said slowly.
"Suffer not the weak, for they break the will of even the strongest among you."
"Yes,
A good speech, despite the speaker.
Amatnam lifted his bolt pistol meaningfully.
Do you understand why I asked you the question?
Yattel hesitated.
Yes.
You are one of Lacomhue's. I know this, and you know this. But now, you are also one of mine. Do you understand?
Again, Yattel hesitated. Amatnam leaned close until their helms were almost touching.
Yes, brother. I understand.
It sounded as if Yattel were biting off the end of every word.
Good. Now stand.
He spotted a crowd of cultists edging through the ruined shelves, their weapons extended before them.
You there! Come here and support this warrior!
The cultists hurried towards them and eagerly took Yattle's weight, though it bent them nearly double.
Take him back to the gunships!
Amatnam tapped Yattel in the chest.
Remember this moment, brother. It is in your best interests.
Ha! Artfully done, my lord!
Apis said approvingly, as Amatnam joined him and the others.
Mercy has a keen edge.
Amatnam checked his bolt pistol's ammunition.
Let us pray it is so, brother. Else I might wish I had killed him here.
He looked up.
Sound off! Does anyone have eyes or augur sign on our quarry?
The vox crackled.
I see them. They're heading for the causeway.
He knew the voice, a low, oily purr. A warrior named Sapa, one of Apis's followers. Amatnam gestured, and Apis and the others started towards the causeway.
Can you intercept?
The roar of the battle sister's heavy bolter sounded from somewhere above.
Not at the moment. The Yuvos pinned. My apologies, my lord.
No matter. May the gods watch over you, brother.
And you, my lord.
They've split up,
Apis said.
Buying time. Someone is trying to get back into the bastion. We must see that they don't.
He started forward, the others following. They broke into a run, hurdling fallen shelves and chunks of broken pillar